Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a conversation about all things happening that aren't Bitcoin. I'm Derek Graham, CEO of Portal Asset Management. And of course, I have with me my friend and colleague, Nitin Gaur. Hello, Nitin.
Hey, Derek. Glad to be here again. A great week and a lot to talk about. So looking forward to another exciting week here.
Terrific. So, of course, the standard thing we must say is that this is a conversation. This is discussing what's happening with news and information for the week and our views on it. This is not financial advice. So a good way to start this is going through some of the great headlines just to show maybe this, the sense and momentum of what's happening with cryptocurrencies and the world of digital assets now. One of my favorite ones for you watching is The Economist. And The Economist has written this fantastic article called Down the Rabbit Hole, The Promise and Perils of Decentralized Finance. And in typical Economist form, beautifully written, nicely balanced, well-researched. You can find that online, their sort of introductory article on it, and you can see their discussion in more detail. But the fact is, everyone, this is about decentralized finance, and it's on the front cover of The Economist. So not as if it's going to sneak under any major government's horizon or radar, or that any major economist isn't going to be able to see decentralized finance. It really is the premier place for this to be sitting in. Let's go through a few other stories about what's happening in, and that is Bitcoin's now has, you know, Bitcoin depots now has over 5,000 machines operating throughout America, which is quite extraordinary. So they've seen the number of kiosks triple in the last 6 months. The important thing about this is it's giving more users access to cryptocurrency transactions without requiring a bank or a third-party financial provider. Then we also see that in 2021, Bitcoin for advisors is on in October the 6th, which is a virtual online CoinDesk event. Now, the intriguing thing about this is, again, another example of it, of Bitcoin becoming mainstream. Now, look, this is about beyond Bitcoin, but we all know Bitcoin is an on-ramp to this space. So the word's going to be used through here. So Bitcoin Advisor is designed to equip investment advisors with the tools to best understand how Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other digital assets can successfully impact their clients' portfolios. That's on October the 6th. It's a virtual conference put on by CoinDesk. Again, an extraordinary on-ramp to this space. And here's another on-ramp. Visa's working on blockchain interoperability hub for crypto payments. So Visa's new blockchain interoperability project is designed to serve as a network of blockchain networks to be a universal adapter of blockchains that can be connected in multiple cryptocurrencies, including stable coins, as well as central bank currencies, et cetera. Bitcoin's research team is working on this universal payment channel initiative, a blockchain interoperability hub connecting multiple blockchain networks and enabling transfers of digital assets from different protocols and wallets. In other words, Visa sees this as a threat. They see that they need to be able to be relevant in what is otherwise an extraordinary decentralized payment gateway. And they see they can play a positive role in this. And so Nitin, you know, I'd like to chat to you about that shortly, because I know that you've worked a lot with Visa along the way in payment gateways. But also you've often consulted to different countries around the world. And we know that New Zealand Central Bank has just simply released a paper on digital currencies. Now, New Zealand's actually a very progressive country. Yeah. They're always looking for new technology and ways to improve themselves. So the Central Bank of New Zealand has outlined the major benefits of central bank digital currencies, designs based upon the blockchain technology. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand published an issued paper providing its perspective on central bank digital currencies. The paper outlines CBDC purposes, designs, as well as potential benefits and associated risks. The bank will be seeking comments on this paper. The document focuses on general purpose CBDCs, and that is a digital currency issued to any individual or business that wants to use it. So not just a CBDC between banks, but a CBDC to the open economy.
Right.
However, meanwhile, on planet China, things are going in the opposite direction. So coin exchange, crypto exchange has been asked to remove all mainland Chinese users by October. So what we're seeing here is, you know, that China is trying to shut down every one of its users, trying to control all of its people so that they can't trade any cryptocurrency but their own central bank digital currency, their yuan that they've got there. And they've given the users of coin exchange until the end of October to be off the exchange to transact their tokens. So what's likely to occur is that they're going to transact their tokens to another exchange or somewhere else in the world, because they sure as hell ain't going to write them off. And so what you're going to see is the Chinese, who are one of the largest holders of cryptocurrencies in the world, by the way, yeah, keep their assets overseas. So what's happening in China? We've heard so many Chinese bans. They're starting to become boring. When I'm reading them, I think they're the same press release. What's been happening over the years with China, Nitin?
Yeah, it's certainly interesting, because now you yawn like, okay, another ban. And so I did some research in preparation for this session, Derek, a historical sort of timeline of when things transpired. And let's start from the very first time in June, when, you know, 2008 financial crisis, Bitcoin was announced in terms of a truly decentralized world currency, which sort of is in context with the global financial crisis. It was released. And at the time, China announced that it's going to prohibit all virtual currencies. And Bitcoin wasn't mentioned, but Bitcoin was the only currency, including some of the private ones with Hashcash and so on and so forth. Mm. 5 years later, December 2013, in many cases, PBOC, or People's Bank of China, which we back in the day we had worked with them, I was still early days of blockchain in a DLT project back in the day, and they said, you know, we don't want any bank. And that was true for many countries at the time, because they didn't, it was always unknown and it was very early stages, and they didn't want their banks to do anything with Bitcoin. So if you recall back in the day, if you had to open an account and you couldn't really move money, and I bought my Bitcoin a year before the Chinese ban, and I had to write a check, which is interesting in its own right, just you're writing a check to buy a Bitcoin. Or you mine it, which not everybody had the infrastructure or the energy cost and so on and so forth. January 2014, the prices fall again. Alibaba, Baidu, under directions of the government, proactively banned Bitcoin transactions. And this was the time when the rise of Alibaba was preeminent, both in terms of what transpired later, with that world. September 2017, 3 years later, Chinese authorities, they begin to shutter all the Bitcoin exchanges. And every time that happened, you would see a fall in Bitcoin prices. May 2021, which is this year, when Bitcoin was $37,000, previous all the bans. In many cases, China became the mining hub. China was sort of leading in every facet of the industry, where you had massive mining rigs, massive focus on energy utilization. And at that point, the world was thinking like, well, China has sort of won this battle. And we were looking at the US and saying, you know, you're sort of losing the grip on technology because of either regulation or because of the fact that the energy cost is so high and you don't really have a focus. And suddenly you begin to see innovation in chipsets, innovation in energy grids and so on and so forth. So at that time, it was a massive growth in that space, except a week later in May, with the Chinese sort of Politburo looking into a greener China and having those commitments begin to ban the mining rig. So if you remember, between May and September, which is now, a lot of mining companies have either moved to Kazakhstan, and they begin to now crack down on in-house mining, because the sale of GPUs, which is a specialized chip that goes into mining, was being procured by people for home mining. And they said, you know, we'll do this at home, yes, and we'll combine. At the end of the day, it's a grid. So if you combine it's a decentralized computing platform. If the entire block on a neighborhood decides to connect and pool the resources, you don't really need a design rig for that. You can still use that whole. And so they begin to crack down on those sort of individualistic elements based on energy usage and so on and so forth. And the final sort of hammer came down in 2021, which is, in my opinion, significant. This ban, which I think, you know, about seventh ban in the entire lineage of all the bans. So this is the mother of all bans, I would say, because 10 regulatory agencies, the Banking Commission, the Security and Exchange Commission in China, and various agencies, including the municipality who's involved with the energy consumption, they all have come together on this to say we will ban all aspects of this, whether it's exchanges, whether it's using as monetary instrument, whether it's individuals carrying the coins, whether it's... So they have looked into all facets of commerce, all facets of treasury, and they said we're going to just stop altogether. And I'll say one more thing before I hand it back to you is I begin to wonder why. Why would you look into this massive innovation the country has made in energizing the population and leading to all kinds of innovation, whether it's technology, whether it's new chipsets, whether it's application of new algorithms and creating new financial products. And I think China, many companies from China, many innovators and many entrepreneurs from China were coming up with some amazing ideas in that space. And I think there are a few reasons. One is there's already but there's a controlled information flow in the country, as we all know. Social media is not fairly open. You have a very domestic agenda. Second thing is capital flights. Now, if you remember, Bitcoin is still store of value. So instead of gold and diamonds and things that are hard to leave the country, Bitcoin is fairly as a store value and you know, compared with gold, it's an easier way to take the money out of the country. And that's one of the biggest agenda of PBOC is to prevent capital flights, and you have capital controls. In fact, every country has capital controls, including free economies. And they would like to actually understand why the money is leaving the country, because it has impact on economy, impact on money supply and inflation and so on and so forth. So some of those macroeconomic elements come under scrutiny when Bitcoin reaches a level where, you know, 1,000 Bitcoin can really have a dent to the economic system. And if that begins to happen, then, you know, you have a capital outflow. But at the same time, I think in many cases, the central bank digital currency rollout, they would like it to be the single sort of currency of sorts, so not to compete with any of the currencies, yes, not to create confusion. But to me, it is all about capital outflows, which was one of the prime reasons. At the same time, they didn't want to, you know, what we have seen, the whole drama with Jack Ma, is create these ultra billionaires who have, you know, enormous amount of power for them to be able to take, you know, this massive outflow of capital, causing a significant challenge to the regime. So there's a little bit of political, economic, and overall thematic element of economic controls that was at play here. So I'll pause at that. I know it was a good way for me to research these things and look into say, okay, how many bans did China do? And to me, this is mother of all bans. So I'm going to call it Moab.
Mother of all bans. Hey, Nitin. What did the price of Bitcoin do during these bans? What was it like? You know, you saw Bitcoin some 90 days after each ban, and where did it go after that?
So usually every time China in the past had, this is before the Moab, you know, you would see a massive dip. So this is even as early as May, when the mining was banned, you would saw a big dip. Well, there is two reasons for that. One, because a significant part of hash power was gone.
Yep.
And the network has to scramble again to bring back to the same level of hash power. So there's a little bit of that capacity and supply issue. But, you know, it took a dip. But this particular ban, which was, I would say, significant, did not see a lot of blip, either because we were just tired and fatigue. The ban fatigue set in, say, okay, you know what, one more ban, who cares? And not everybody really cared about that. But second thing, I think, is... you know, the world is questioning to see how much of this is really possible. You cannot really control technology to an extent where they can still move Bitcoin over USBs. So while they can still control the online elements, remember this is still a peer-to-peer currency. So I can still engage in a peer-to-peer transaction. I can still look into a capital outflow. I can still look into the in-currency, in-country Bitcoin that still exists with people in their wallets, whether it's hardware wallets or they have paper wallets and whatever mechanism they choose to use. Remember this, in most blockchain world, and Bitcoin is a prime example, the asset doesn't live in your wallet, on your house, or in your bank. Asset lives on the chain. It's the claim of the asset is what you carry. So asset is still on the chain. And if you can claim the asset with that private key of yours, it's just a matter of either memorizing it. And I can guarantee you that knowing Chinese culture, they're quite capable of memorizing the entire key or finding an avenue to be able to move the key in some location that they can have access to. So it's incredibly difficult for them to. So all they can do is block the establishments, block the online transactional element of it. But I don't think they can completely. And so that set in, and I don't think there was a massive impact on this Moab, on the price of Bitcoin this time, because in this time, I don't think it was neither demand supply issue. It was just business as usual, I would say.
So I've got some numbers here that correspond with that, those particular announcements, the many announcements all the way back from, you know, May in 2013. And that is that they turn around and they say, what was the price of Bitcoin, the indicator at that time, for 1 day, 7 days, 30 days, and 90 days? And so way back then, it dropped 18% in 1 day. And after 90 days, it was still 35% down. So the impact of that announcement on the global market of cryptocurrencies was very significant. As it progresses, you start to see the last one that we've recorded was in June this year on the 18th, because the data, of course, hasn't come through with the recent recording because the history hasn't occurred. And so it was down 1% for the first day, 7%, then 17%, and then up 26%. So in other words, you're actually seeing the market always dipping a little bit after the announcement, and the market actually turning around and saying, look, we really don't care. It's not going to affect our global view on the use of digital assets. So, but you talked before about China and, you know, reasons for it. Now, of course, as you know, China's going through an energy crisis because they've been going through a political battle with Australia. And to hurt Australia, they decided they weren't going to buy coal from us. And Australia produces the best coal in the world, and so the highest BTUs per kilogram. And so they've done that, and that's caused them huge economic grief because they're shutting down sections all around the place, industries, suburban areas, et cetera, because they just simply don't have enough good quality coal. Of course, we in Australia are bleeding for them. But nonetheless, so one of the things they would have been doing is they're interested in shutting down the energy consumption of it. But I really don't think that either the energy consumption, their concern about hash rates, even to a degree, the overseas flight of money, although that's important to them, I think that the Chinese yuan and the blockchain that they have developed, and remember at one stage they had 1,200 plus patents, family of patents that China had versus America at less than 1,000. So in other words, they were 20% ahead of America with development. So they're not stopping their development. I just think they're using it for a totally different purpose. And so my view is that if you look at China and you realize they're starting to put in merit systems for their citizens to become, to work hard for their country and increase the number of merits they have, which gives them higher social standing and incomes, et cetera, you realize that the yuan, if placed on a controlled blockchain, China could turn off a particular apartment down the street at level 32. They could turn off an individual, and that individual could never buy food again. They could never transact. They could never move. Their ability to totally and utterly control their people through the currency, I think, is their ultimate goal. And anything to do with another digital asset or a digital currency is a threat to them. However, as we discussed earlier on, this is probably going to be a game of them running around with a hammer and hitting moles on the head each time they pop out of the ground. Because what is a fungible token? What is a digital asset? What is a currency to transact? Well, as we know, gaming currencies are fantastic. You know, you can get a gun or a shield or whatever else. You know, where are we going with this? And of course, all of a sudden, it becomes the default economy. You watch This is going to be constantly happening. The more that China closes down its people, the more they're going to work out how to transact outside that scope. And it's likely to be in things like gaming tokens, I think. What do you think?
No, I've seen the same thing to a colleague of mine to say, you know, 12,000 plus different tokens in the marketplace and ever-growing NFTs and gamify, which is the term that's beginning to come to prominence. That's exactly what it is, that you can block one or two currencies, but how do you go after an ever-growing ecosystem of these in-gaming currency and in-gaming, where it's no longer play to win, it's play to earn model. And that itself becomes currency of sorts. So I was wondering as to what is the framework? And so we have an opposite problem in the US, where we're figuring out how do you define an asset class? And I think China in cases, how do you have a framework that begins to start, you know, having a whack-a-mole situation where a new currency pops up, which is happening on a daily basis? How do you control that? Well, you can't really shut down the internet, you know, that has a much more drastic concerns around this. And I do like the patent analogy too. Suddenly now, you know, which I think China was notorious for not respecting intellectual property. And now that they have the highest amount of patents in Bitcoin, it's to be seen if they get back to respecting intellectual property and respecting patents, because now they do have, I think there was an analysis when I was filing patents, and I still do, blockchain space, that Alibaba alone had highest patents of all the US companies combined in blockchain space. That includes Bank of America, that includes IBM, that includes, and so while IBM is known for, like my company, my employer is known for filing the highest amount of patents from the last 20 plus years, in blockchain space, we are still a distant second to Alibaba as a company. So I think it's a telling sign to say, you know, that they have certainly put their energy. But when you ban it, to your point, what happens to that intellectual capital? Are we using it, or is it just to protect? And I don't know if that's the right thing to do. You know, so I think I always believe that instead of banning technology, they should ban activities and instruments, as opposed to just stopping everything, because then you are stopping innovation. But it's we'll see how this surfaces out, I think.
Many years ago, I traveled in an aeroplane from Hamilton Island to Sydney. And I traveled with a woman who was a risk analyst. And I asked what she did, and she works for the New Zealand government. And she analyzes the risk of the New Zealand government's on the impact of certain aspects on the brand of New Zealand government. Because the New Zealand has a brand. When we think about New Zealand, it's clean, it's beautiful, its people are friendly, its rugby players are not friendly. They're incredibly good, and they've got a slightly funny accent as far as we Australians are concerned, and so New Zealand is a progressive country, and even Australia is impressed with a lot of their progressive movements, and their central bank is looking at producing a real CBDC. By the looks of it, it's early days from what they've released here. But it's a CBDC that could operate from banks to business, sorry, from the central bank to businesses and central bank around the place. What do you think that might mean for a little country economically like New Zealand, and how it might compete on a global basis?
Yeah, I think, again, I'm a huge fan of New Zealand. I've expressed the interest to eventually move to New Zealand someday because of the same reason you just described: friendly people, great environment, clean food, clean air, all the great things, not to mention that I'm a huge fan of Jacinda as well as an amazing sort of leader for the stuff that she's done. But from a going back to the CBDC conversation, Derek, I think it's another great step in progressing the economic agenda. As you know, Asia Pacific, there are a lot of trading partners between New Zealand and Australia and the Singapore and the Southeast Asia region. There's a lot of momentum in driven by MAS, which is Monetary Authority of Singapore, and digitizing a lot of things that includes money and digitizing commerce and digitizing trade. So it's not just digitizing money movement, which has to go through an exchange mechanism. And recently MAS or Monetary Authority of Singapore has laid out a framework for them to connect the payment systems between India and Singapore, which is a big amount of cash flow between those two countries only because of the commerce and the expat population, but also between Malaysia and Singapore. another sort of massive amount of inflow of labor and capital coming from, you know, and they have done similar efforts in conversation with Australia, and this is all public information, of course. So I think it's more than just payments. It's facilitating a true digital way to interact, for facilitating commerce, for inducing, addressing the small and large business liquidity challenges, and addressing the working capital issues, which leads to a lot of downstream impact of borrowing and lending and the cost structure that goes with it. So I think this effort, this initiative, is not just empowering and building that modern financial infrastructure that, you know, a country of 4+ million people can benefit from, but it's rather relatively easier for them to implement, considering United States and India and China as large countries with 1+ billion people, especially India and, yes. and China. The notion of education, the notion of digital penetration, all that is not as big of a problem as it is in countries like India and some of the emerging economies. So I think for them, it's certainly achievable with the progressive country that they are. But it's, to me, it's not just about enabling digital payments. It's about, you know, plugging into the changing nature of commerce and global movement of money.
Yes, yes. Actually, look, you know, meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren still thinks this is a space for drug lords and nasty billionaires. So I say that in a laughing manner, because there is a lot of laggard signs that are happening with a lot of the bigger nations of the world, particularly the US. And yeah. yet, on the other hand, the very first nation in the world to put their currency on a blockchain was Bermuda. And and they created the Bermuda Sand token, I think they called it.
Bahamas.
And it was the Bahamas Sand token because the governor of the Bahamas is an ex-software engineer and understood the merits of the technology and wham, created that. But what's interesting about that is that's a micro country. And New Zealand is a very small country too. What we might see is a lot of these bigger countries getting dragged along because the smaller countries are starting to implement the technology. They're not fighting the politics as much. They're seeing an opportunity to compete, because a lot of this discussion today is about on-ramps. The fact that, yeah. that you know, there's ATMs all over the place to convert into Bitcoin, you know, without banks involved, the fact that major advisors conferences are occurring for people to invest in it, the fact that Visa's working on how to implement interoperability between blockchains, New Zealand's talking about central bank utilization and digitization of its country, all of these things are major on-ramps. Yeah, but there's sure. legacy industries that are out there still, and of course huge legacy industries yeah. of existing economies. So do you think what we'll see is a lot of these smaller nations leading the way with the best initiatives, and also a lot of the developing nations that might also be able to utilize this and lead the way?
Yeah, you're onto something, Derek. And I'll tell you, in all my global travels, and again, a qualifying statement is pre-pandemic, I have always seen like countries like Philippines and countries like Bahamas, and we've been there, you know, on many occasions for Sand Dollar Project, the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, which is the Barbados and the group of islands which form the seven countries or seven islands that form the Eastern Caribbean Central Banks, New Zealand now. I think there's an impetus for many of the emerging economies to see this as an avenue to get ahead. Like if you look at the internet era, and I always compare that to internet because there is information revolution, this is value revolution, is that internet gave a lot of advantage to the United States because it was born here with DARPA and the projects in terms of, you know, and there were many reasons why it was born here. But that's no longer the case. I don't think any country has a natural advantage anymore because the information has leveled the playing field. And I believe that most smaller countries view this as an avenue to get ahead or get to, you know, get ahead and get, you know, level the playing field in economic terms, which today it's the Western nations, United States, Europe have a natural advantage because of capital markets, because of the legal framework that we have. And in many cases, they believe that the technology itself, which is blockchain as underlying technology, and the protocols that are developing on blockchain, which is the trust protocols and that provide natural advantage to sort of creating a framework for what's to come in terms of the legal framework. I think that's the thought process here. And you will always yes. find that the countries who are like, especially United States and Europe, who have more to lose because they have a lot more expensive systems that they have to convert yes. and change, and the cost of the conversion is very expensive. I find that US will be probably one of the last countries, even though we have enough innovation, we have enough capital flow from investment, venture capital in the space, we were the last countries to adopt this because US dollar is still the global world's, you know, world's currency and world's reserve. And so we have to fully understand the risk, and that process hasn't even begun yet. I mean, there's been a lot of rhetoric, but no one spent time in actually understanding the ripple effect of converting or having a stable coin or USDC of sorts, right? So that's yet to be seen, I think. But let me ask you one thing, Derek. As we talk about China and we talk about the global footprint, with all that we've discussed with China, do you see China and US as a zero-sum game? Do you see, because suddenly now you see a bit more positive vibes, both in, and I'm happy to rattle off a few legal nuggets that have happened this week, which are inching towards positivity, that, you know, it's, and the inflow of capital for developing rigs, mining rigs and the new infrastructure. And I'm just wondering, is this because China banned and we've realized that, okay, you know, the giant has backed off, let's go and grab the market that historically was theirs because of investments and because of energy availability? What do you think? What's going on there?
I think China plays a long game, and a game that America doesn't and can't play. And that long game is ultimately to expand the Chinese footprint. You know, we're seeing indicators such as the fact that they've put the brakes off the minimizing major population growth. They basically said, increase your population, grow a lot more. There are 1.4 billion people already, and they intend to expand that rapidly. Well, I don't think that's just to put into China. I think they intend to expand. They own the South China Sea, or they're trying to own the South China Sea, which is the absolute corridor for trading to all of Southeast Asia, sure, et cetera. Their discussions in regards to expansion into Taiwan, I don't think there's any ambiguity in it at all. That's our country. Now, you visited Taiwan, I visited Taiwan, and it's not China. It's their people are very different, and their rationale of thinking is different. Their hopes and aspirations are different. It's not the same country. And, sure, and so I do see there's a real interest in expanding. And so if there's any sort of pullback on the way through, I just think it's part of playing the longer game. At the same time, they're also getting quite in heavily indebted. You know, we saw Evergrande with $300 billion in debt, but that's small in comparison to the local government debts, et cetera, they've got, which I think, was it $3 or $4 trillion they announced? And so these are huge debts that China's creating. So it has an expansionist program, but it is generating a lot of debt to do some of that. And so between their social engineering, which we're seeing so much of at the moment, between their saber rattling, which we're seeing a great deal of at the moment, I think China's path forward at the moment seems pretty clear, and that's to expand. How the rest of the world copes with that is going to be interesting. And so we're seeing alliances between America, Australia, Japan, and India. Interesting alliance.
The Quad.
And that alliance is showing force, saying we're concerned. Each one of those groups is concerned in regards to China's expansion. I think we're going to see technology in the same way. China's controlling its yuan, it's controlling its blockchains. Meanwhile, around the world, there are other great technologies getting developed, which are more open source. And those are often faster, more efficient, and more effective. So we might see this world start competing in a cyberspace, not just in a hacking cyberspace that we know it does exist, but in a cyberspace of commerce. So that's my view. Hey, non-fungible tokens. Let's end it on another note there.
Yes.
And that's Dapper Labs and what they did during the week.
So it's interesting. Last week was a pretty interesting week. Dapper Labs raised $250 million. So Rare raised $680 million, which is like unheard of numbers. And then you have amongst all of this, a social token called Roll that raised $10 million. And I'm thinking that, you know, back in the day, if you remember, if anybody raised $10 million, it was a big deal, like, wow, $10 million.
Yes.
And
yes,
you know, you need A round, B round, C round to become a unicorn.
Yeah.
And many of these companies like Dapper Labs and Sorare are already unicorn because they've raised enough funding now to have the valuation of $1 billion or higher. And that to me, again, is a affirmation of solidification of this social, technological, and economic sort of models that's evolving, which is the convergence of all these three elements is solid. And I think Twitter made an announcement this week. They made two announcements. One announcement was using Lightning Network to tip, and they didn't use the word payments, which is interesting. They use the word tipping, which is moving Bitcoin from me to you on Twitter. And as I'm sending you a message, if I can connect my wallet, I can use the Lightning Network to be able to move Bitcoin to Derek in an instant. And I think that should be concerning for the work that Visa is doing and MasterCard is doing, because that is a payment system. It is a global payment system that's been evolving. So that's one. But more importantly, which sort of got hidden away, is NFT verification. So imagine Derek spends 10 Ether, which is $30,000 to buy an art. And Derek wants to be able to showcase the art. Twitter now has an avenue or it's on its way to let Derek put that as a part of his icon and have a green checkbox to say, you know what, this is actually owned by Derek. So, you know, it does two things. It's laying the foundation for true sense of ownership of digital content, which doesn't exist today. I can cut and paste, I can copy PDFs, I can copy an image, and I can keep it on my desktop. But suddenly now you have a verification validation that this actually belongs to Derek. And the protocols involved in moving the digital content is beginning to surface, which was non-existent in digital economy until now. And so that's a significant element, which has much, much higher implications than simply moving the Bitcoins or payment instruments of Bitcoin tipping. But imagine a world that if I'm on Twitter, can I not use Twitter as a platform to exchange my NFT for your Bitcoins? And that is something that actually I've been thinking about while my running in the afternoon to say, you know, what will that world look like? Can I be on Twitter? Next thing you know, I have my wallet attached to it. I can use Twitter as an exchange mechanism. The long aforementioned dream of using social media network to say, I can send you a text, I can send you an image, let me also send you something of value while we're at it.
Yes, of course.
And I see that evolving, and I see, again, the funding pouring into the things that we collect and we own and going after every taxi driver in New York to a farmer in maybe Vietnam and all having some role to play in some form of fashion.
I agree.
In things that we love and like and connect to some social platform. I can see that happen in the next 5 years, if that makes sense.
I mean, this is the great social democratization of assets and one that I think is probably the single greatest social impact of blockchain will be the democratization of assets. But nonetheless, I'm sure other people would argue it's the payment.
But you know, system, who will not, who, you know, Derek, a question for you. With this Twitter, who will not get the asset or the Bitcoins? Which country is disadvantaged from this phenomenon? Because you can't have Twitter in China. So if I can't tweet China. I cannot send NFTs, I cannot send. And I think that is the disadvantage that they're missing. The entire sort of evolution from that perspective, I think.
But they may well be trying to create that within their own closed ecosystem. But I tell you, one of the things that interests me with the $680 million, $250 million investments is that from a fund management point of view, these are fascinating because there's been some $17 billion invested up until June 30 this year from venture capitalists. Well, those $17 billion are going to result in new tokens, new financial solutions, new gaming solutions, new art and trade transaction solutions, new exchanges, et cetera. And from the point of view of Portal Asset Management and the Portal Digital Fund, they all represent 18 months down the line, new opportunities to invest. And I find that fascinating. So I think, you know, to wrap up today's discussion, here we are, we've discussed the fact that just in 1 week, there's all of these on-ramps that we've seen. You know, we've seen the Visa on-ramps and the Bitcoin machines increasing and the financial planners getting together on a regular basis and discussing on-ramping this investment space. And then we see China and what it's trying to do to control its population using the technology. But then we see New Zealand wanting to expand and become more globalized from it. And we're seeing NFTs come on board, Twitter trying to become a little bit more of a segue rather than a centralized environment that no one generates income from but Twitter, because they see NFTs and social media operating off decentralized blockchains as being no doubt a challenge to them. And then we're seeing $17 billion of development occurring. Gee, Nitin, we're just at the beginning of this still, aren't we? There's still so much more to come.
It's a never-ending thing. And I'll tell you, every time I come, we do this. Of course, we prepare for the content and what is the right media. And it's on a daily basis, Derek, it's the hardest things to keep up. There's so much happening in the world. There are so many new companies coming in the world with some amazing ideas popping up. So you're absolutely right that I think this is just the beginning. And I think at Portal Asset Management, our thinking, what we're doing, as well as in our daily jobs that we do, I think it's going to be an exciting ride ahead, I think. So I'm looking forward to that.
Very much so. Drinking from the fire hydrant, I call it. All right. Well, thanks very much. It's always lovely to chat with you. And I hope everyone's enjoyed the conversation. Please like or subscribe, make comments, give us suggestions, topics you may wish to discuss. We're totally open to that. I'm available at derick@portal.am and Nitin, Nitin, at portal.am. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week and we'll chat next week. Bye for now.
That's right. See you all next week. Derek, great talking to you again. Chat later.
Good on you, Nitin. See you.
Bye.